a man of many talents today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Randy Richards has worked at many things during his life. We'll concentrate on his writings today on Scribble. Randy, in addition to teaching a variety of things, you have written books, a play, you write poetry. Why don't you take a rest sometime?
You know, you remind me of the Stephen Leacock hero who jumped on his horse and rode off madly in all directions. Because in a sense, you've done that with your life.
I've had a lot of varied interests. Okay, and I think one of the things that's important is to engage with whatever's in front of you with some kind of passion and intensity, and so whatever sort of comes up, right? And it's been many things, I think, through my life.
Well, you seem to really start things new. I can recall a bull session in my early 20s, just after I'd graduated from college, in which we speculated that it would really be fun to spend our lives starting over again. 10 years, you know, from 20 to 30, I'd have one career. Then the other thing I wanted to do, I'd do from 30 to 40, instead of just 50 continuous years teaching or something like that. You know, most kids come to college with varied interests. I want to be a ballet dancer, but I want to be an animal doctor, and I want to be a forest ranger. You could be all those. And you, in a sense, more than any person I know, have been a lot of different things.
I have been a lot of different things. And looking back on it, you know, I've been a lot of different things. I've done a lot of different things. And I still think, even in my advancing years, I've got some things in front of me that I still want to experiment with.
That's an admirable ambition. When you talk in those terms, I guess I have done different things in my life.
You have. I think about all of – we talked before about all of the different things you've done, right?
Well, you know, but you talked, too, about Campbell saying there's a certain arc in all these disparate – and to me, looking for that arc, I thought teaching. I think mainly I'm a teacher. And I've looked for the magisterial function in all of those things.
Yeah. I think that's a nice point. And even through – and, you know, we're continuing to talk about the business stuff. But even through all the years I was a supervisor and manager, I thought my job primarily was to help people understand what needed to be done. It was a teaching approach to this, a way of getting people involved and understanding what needed to be done. And so I think that's always been the arc there. I didn't realize it for a long time, but looking back, as Campbell has said, maybe that it has been it. And the writing is a way to do that too, I think.
See, Tweet, you were just spot on all the way.
I know. I just spent 40 years doing one thing, right?
Yeah, well.
Maybe not. Maybe it's one thing in one way, but maybe there were other things as well, yes?
You messed up a lot of lives along the way, Tweet.
I would not have had the nerve to do what Randy has done. That's it, pure and simple. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, all of a sudden somebody says, well, why don't you come over in Ambrose and do this, Randy? Okay, I'll do it, right? I mean, and then somebody else 10 years later suggests this, and you do it. And in the meantime, you know, you dabble in poetry. You've written a crime novel. You've written
four plays.
Nonfiction, four plays.
One's produced. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You make me dizzy, Randy. What prompted you to start writing books?
What prompted me to start writing books was my he'll be embarrassed by this, but my youngest son James, who had a real creative interest in writing and was doing some writing, and it got me to thinking about it too. So I admired his work. He's also written a kind of crime novel. And he edited this for me. And I have a lot of admiration for him. And his excitement and interest in writing and expressing himself that way stimulated my own.
So he was the first one to write the crime novel, and then you?
We wrote it almost at the same time. I did some writing in high school.
Right.
But I kind of left it behind. One of the interesting things, stories about that is, if you've read Stephen King's book on writing, which is an interesting book, King was doing some fantasy and science fiction writing in high school, right? And he kept doing it. I showed it to the nuns, and they said, "That's a waste of time. Stop doing that." So I stopped. So I stopped for a long time. So Stephen King paid no attention to that. Look where he is, and I'm here with you two. Okay, where's the justice in that? Right. So I began early doing it, but then it kind of petered out. But when James got interested and he started doing it, it reignited my own interest in it, and so he kind of got me interested in doing it again.
How do you account for poetry?
I don't know what to say to that. It just happens, I think, sometimes. Oh, I actually have a better idea about that. I do, in a way. And that was I became interested at one point in Asian haikus, Japanese poetry and Japanese art and Japanese culture. And I became interested in that, and that stimulated my interest in poetry. So that came in the door via the East.
So is your poetry haiku-like?
Generally it is. Mm-hmm. It's not strictly that way, but it is more reflective of an Eastern orientation.
I know you don't have any with you. Can you remember?
No. I'd have to have it in front of me.
Yeah, you know, earlier we were talking, and you said you're watching an action movie and it had an opera in it, and that suddenly steered you into opera. You are a very impressionable person.
I am. Right. Probably too impressionable. I'm worried about being with the two of you and what impression that's going to leave.
Yeah, well. A life of indolence lies ahead of you.
A whole new career.
Well, give us an example of your writing.
Well, you asked me to pick something from the book.
Yeah.
Okay. And the book, the name of the book is The Unseen Hand of Peter Gyges.
Read the blurb on the back, because blurbs seldom make me want to read the book, but that makes me want to.
Did it really? Thank you.
Read this, because it moves in the opposite direction from most mysteries.
Oh, thanks. Okay,
listen to this, Don.
This is the blurb on the back. When Peter Gyges paddled out to his favorite fishing spot on a northern Minnesota lake, his highest aspiration for the day comes with scales and fins. But instead of peace and relaxation, a ferocious thunderstorm drives him to seek refuge on a remote island. Washed upon the shore, he finds a prize that turns out to be even more valuable than he first imagines. The power of that discovery changes his life from law-abiding everyman to ruthless corporate manipulator, and in the wake of that arc brings him with it deception, betrayal, and murder.
Don't you want
to? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's really well written blurb.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So, do you have a passage from.
Well, I was not prepared to do this, but I will. Okay. So, let me find a minute here.
Where could we, meanwhile, get a copy of this? Where is it available?
Oh, it's available on Amazon.
Okay.
And so, it's The Unseen Hand of Peter Gyges, and I use my initials, R.L. Richards. Maybe if I talked a little bit about the background of this,
okay,
it would be helpful.
Yeah.
This is really the origin of this story is Plato, the second book. Okay, of course, right? The second book of the Republic, which is the story of the Ring of Gyges. And Gyges, the story is this, if you may recall, maybe you don't. Okay, that's not critical. There's a shepherd by the name of Gyges. He lived in the province of Lydia, and his job was to tend sheep. Okay, and at one point, a huge thunderstorm arose, causing an earthquake. And the earth opens up, and there's a huge chasm in the earth. And Gyges looks in the cabin, and he sees this bronze horse glistening at the bottom of the cavern. And so he goes down in there, and there's doors on the side of the bronze horse. And he opens the doors, and there's this large naked man laying inside the horse. And he has a ring on his finger. And Gyges steals the ring and puts the ring on his own finger and emerges from the chasm. That night, sitting around the fire, and it says this in Plato, by the way, discussing the monthly report that had to be filed with the chief shepherd. I'm going, in 500 BC, they're filing monthly reports. We're still filing monthly reports. Something is wrong, okay? But it says in Plato, they're discussing the monthly report. He's fooling with his ring, and he finds when he turns the signet towards him, people start talking about him as if he's not there. They're gossiping about him. And he realizes he's invisible. Mm. Okay, so now the question is, am I wasting my life being a shepherd? Yes. So he gets a job as messenger to the king, uses the ring to turn himself invisible. Where does he go? The queen's boudoir, of course, seduces the queen, and he and the queen together conspire to kill the king. And he becomes the king of Lydia.
Oh.
And that's the story.
Whoa.
That's the story. So now my thought about this was, okay, what would happen to an everyman like Gyges today if this happened? And so this had percolated with me for a long time. I had done pieces on it. I had taught pieces of it. I'd done different things with it. And finally I decided I wanted to write this crime novel about Gyges. And so it's Plato meets Stephen King.
Wow.
So that's how this came about. That's how this came about. And it's mine and I like it. This is a really fast
people
read.
People who say philosophy is useless.
Yeah,
do you have a page you can read so we can?
Well, it'll be in the middle of something and we've not planned this.
Yes, yes.
Didn't give him a chance to prepare.
No, I wish I would have known that this. Yeah, okay.
Well, we like to fool people.
Well, this really puts me on the spot.
Well, every page ought to be good, Randy.
Oh, thanks. That's even worse, okay?
Have you found something?
I just pulled something right from the middle, okay? I have no idea. I just opened it up and we'll let it fly, okay? Mm-hmm. Gyges' head was swimming in details. He'd been running for days without much sleep. And though he wasn't near exhausted, he needed some time to recharge his batteries and review his notes. He pulled into the marina parking lot. As he approached the ghost, he noticed a younger man leaning against another boat. He seemed to be keeping his eye on Gyges, singling him out for special attention. The man moved from the boat and walked towards him. Gyges slowed. The man closed the gap with long strides. It didn't seem like the man meant him harm, but Gyges was still uneasy. When the man was within 10 feet, Gyges stopped and gave an unenthusiastic smile. "Good afternoon," the man said. "Are you Peter Gyges?" "Yeah, why?" "Consider yourself served." The man shoved a manila envelope into his hand and strode off towards the marina parking lot. Gyges turned the envelope over in his hand. No markings on the outside. Just a name and a snapshot of him on the ghost. The picture infuriated him. This kind of thing must be against the law, he thought, spying on people without their knowledge. He tore open the envelope. Divorce papers. He shoved them back into the envelope without reading them. Maybe later. He didn't want the distraction now. He walked to the boat and climbed aboard.
Phew. Very good. Just open a page and there's an interesting passage.
So you weren't satisfied with that and you went on to write some plays.
Preceded this.
Okay. Uh-huh.
The plays preceded this. I was interested in the – I'm interested in live theater. We talked about live performances, right. Live music and that, and live theater. And I'm interested in live theater. And I'm in the theater – I'm interested in the theater because it's a collaborative activity, right? Mm-hmm. Writing a novel is a lonely, lonely piece of work, right?
Right.
But theater – as you are, well, Don, who more than you know the collaboration of this, yes? Mm-hmm. It's everybody. The playwright writes something, but that's really, in some sense, it's not the least of it, but it's certainly not the most of it. Everybody has to make a contribution here. Everybody has to be involved in it. And that I liked. I liked the fact that you could launch something and the other people would use that as a vehicle for the expression of their creativity.
But, you know, I think many of us have thought about, certainly I have, thought about writing a play. But the minute I start charging ahead, I think, well, wait, how do I do this? I don't know why it is, but the same way with the novel. How do I do this? Is there a way to do this? What's a proper approach? And I don't know why, but that has stopped me every time.
Hmm.
I am convinced that I'm not a good writer. As I say, I can talk all day, but writing, you put something down on paper and you're caught with it. I mean, that's it.
Oh, it's
yeah, you can't change
it. It's scary.
Yeah, it is. And I'm very private, more so than you would imagine. And the idea of writing something almost seems too revealing, I guess. I don't know.
Do you put on different writing hats for different kinds of writing? I mean, you know, I've had a long-standing argument with friends of mine about whether writing is writing. I did a program in Dallas for Dear once on to managers called Memos and Other Poems, in
cool.
which I claimed that the writing of a poem and the writing of a menu have the same sort of rules about the careful use of language and so forth. Or is writing a play quite different from writing a crime novel?
Yeah, I think it is, in the sense that I have to leave room or space in the play for other people, right? So the actors are going to do something with it. The director is going to do something with it. The stage manager is going to do something with it.
But don't you try to control what's going to happen as much as, or
you give directions like,
or is it really a collaboration? Yeah. Or
I ask people who, you know, in theater, I said, well, how much? I ask directors and stage people, how much direction do you want? Right? Mm-hmm. Do you want to be told exactly what to do, or do you want? And I think to tell them exactly what to do is a mistake. So I tried to create, in all of the plays, I just try to create enough direction to give an indication of it, right? And then I'll believe that tapping into other people's creativity will make what I've done better than I did, because the novel is the novel, right? But you're going to perform the play, and you're going to add something to it that I didn't think of. You will give it a level of meaning maybe beyond what I had intended. You will do things with it.
But not only beyond, but sometimes quite different, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Did that happen to the play that did get put on at Ambrose?
Yeah, we produced a play at Ambrose, my play called Sylvan Slough, which takes place in Moline on the Sylvan Slough, at an actual location, based on, in part, something that had happened to me there. And yeah, there were things going on there that I was totally surprised at. Chris Itram, who's the stage guy at Ambrose, if you've run into Chris, both as director and stage manager, constructed some really interesting sets that I would never have thought of on how to do this. So his staging of it was a surprise, and his staging of it added something to it that I hadn't even thought of. I didn't even envision how it would be staged. I just left that open, and he filled that space with something really interesting.
So you're not George Bernard Shaw, who gives very careful, cogent directions about his plays.
No. No, I'm not. I try to leave space for...
But even that won't work, you know. I mean, different directors put on the same Shaw play, and they're different plays.
Yeah, he tried to keep it within bounds, but that's impossible, because different people have different approaches, and they're all valid, I think.
And that's what you want, right? And
right.
So, that's why it has to be done differently, right? You have to leave more room, right? But even in the novel, you know, one of the things that that I find distressing, both in any kind of writing like this, is disrespecting the reader. That you have to explain everything to the reader, right? You can't have the reader figuring this out on it. Oh, making
right?
That it's like it's demeaning. Well, this is this and this and this. And make sure you understand this and this, right? It's demeaning, right? You have to assume that the reader has some intelligence. And here in the plays, you want to assume that the creativity of the director and the stage people and the actors. And even the audience is going to have something to say about this that's beyond what you thought. That's the beauty of it, isn't it?
As I sit here listening to this and remembering what you said on Saturday Morning Live, it seems to me that's your business philosophy too, right?
It is, to leave space for others. To create space for others,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. And not you're an employee. These are the three tasks you have to do, right?
Yeah.
You encourage them to devise ways of doing it that may not be what you originally intended.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really is the wonderful thing about working with people, is to see how, you know, a task has to be done, and then this is your task, and then see how they approach it. Sometimes they botch it terribly.
They do. Yeah, or that you've botched it terribly and they fixed it for you. Right? That's been my experience as much as the other, I think, more than the other.
So writing off madly in all directions may not be as true as we think it is,
no.
Right? You did have all these different things, but there is a common thread there.
In my approach.
Your view of how things ought to work, whether it's a crime fiction novel or a business.
Yeah. I think if you would scratch underneath, I think you might find a theme for that.
So are you going to keep on writing?
I am. I've got 4 or 5 projects in the tube. The Unseen Hand of Peter Gyges. I've got about a third of the follow up to this written. I haven't been at it for about a year. I wrote about a third of it. I've got to get back to it, and it's called The Unseen Web of Oscar Perkoff. So, 2 of the characters continue from this one to the next one. And so it's the unseen web of Oscar Perkoff.
Have you done book signings and?
Oh no, that would be. It's embarrassing enough to come talk to you about this without
without signing. How do you expect to sell copies of the book?
That's a whole nother issue, right?
Yeah.
Is once you do this, now what?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
It turns out that this is the least of your concerns after you get it written, right? How do you promote it? How do you get people to read it and that kind of thing? And I'm not very good at that.
Wait a minute. You're in business. Come on.
I know. Well, I'm not good at that end of the business. I'm not in the marketing and distribution end. I'm in the management end. Right? I hire those people, right? I just don't have any money to hire them to do this, right?
Right.
Well, that's interesting that you have. How about poetry? Are you continuing with poetry?
I am not. That's not something that I've been involved in at the moment. So I want to do another novel on this. I'm also working on another novel called Sid Hart at Cocoa Beach. I'm doing a novel on that, a kind of piscaret, a novel about what would happen if Buddha lived at Cocoa Beach instead of India. What would that look like? So that's the next project. So it's Siddhartha at Cocoa Beach. So I've just shortened it to Siddhart at Cocoa Beach.
This is what happens when a philosopher becomes unmoored.
That's right. Unhooked. That's right.
Well, Randy, I must say you have given us a lot to think about and a book I have to read. Peter Gyges. Drawing from Plato, read a little Aristotle. I'm sure there's something in there.
I'm sure there is, too.
Randy Richards has been our guest, and we want to thank you very much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you for putting up with me. I appreciate it.
I would think it would be kind of exhausting to be Randy Richards.
Or exhilarating, or probably both. I just reading his resume. I knew him casually through a mutual friend, and he occasionally used to appear with his wife at Hardee's, but I'd sort of lost track of him. I had no idea he did all the different things that he did, and mixing things together that normal people don't do, right? Philosophy teachers sit over here and teach philosophy, and people who teach business and management sit over here and teach business and management. He doesn't seem to see the difference, right?
Don't you think it was because he started being invited to teach an evening course?
Right.
They suddenly needed somebody.
Right, he moved from business
yeah.
and management into philosophy, and I that's probably the way to go.
Yeah, it's just interesting that doors open up sometimes. You just never know, and the scary thing is when a door opens up, do you say yes or no?
Well, you know, it sounds like he's never really ever actually applied for a job, right? People would say, well, oh, we suddenly have this opening here. Could you just fill in and do this? And, you know, pretty soon he's doing it full time. Uh-huh. And then somebody else says, well, how about doing this? We need a little – can you run a workshop up here for our employees? Oh, well, I guess I could. And then pretty soon he's into management and writing books, in fact, about how employees and managers ought to get along.
I was once invited into banking and thought, no.
Right. Well, what Randy does is see the possibilities, right? I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, and to see the possibility and to make something of it, that's leading an adventurous life. You don't have to carry a sword and a shield to lead an adventurous life.
It would scare me, right? I mean, I taught at one place for so many years, 39, that the idea that, you know, I might only be here 3 years, that was my original intention, but, you know, I got way late. I could not live with that uncertainty. But he seems to look forward to it.
Yeah. Well, and that's the kind of adventurous spirit that writes novels and tries poetry and plays and all that stuff.
Amazing.
But, you know, you sell yourself short because you talked about being called to give something for Deere & Company for managers,
right,
and so on. You've stretched a little bit, too.
Except I had a safe job to go back to, right?
Well, you always have a safe job. I think Randy's always had a safe job, too. He's just been able to move to a different one when he's ready.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's his using Plato is a terrific idea. We got about a minute here. Do you have a book to talk about?
I have a book by Amy Schumacher called The Shakespeare Requirement, which is another one of those great novels that takes place in college English departments. There's a whole genre. You know, every people who teach college are already a little weird, right? And all you need to do is tip it over, as Amy Schumacher does, and make it even weirder. But this is about an inept English department. You know, well, Lars Scott, as I read this novel, I remember Lars Scott probably has the best definition of college teaching of anybody that I ever know. Mm-hmm. Do you know what he called teaching in college?
No.
The Revenge of the Nerds.
The Revenge of the Nerds. I see.
And that's us. We'll get even with you.
Yeah, well, what's the name of the book?
The Shakespeare Requirement. It's about a college that decides to maybe do away with the Shakespeare Requirement.
Oh,
which
heresy.
Doesn't
heresy.
Go over well in the English department.
Oh, no, not at all.
And it creates a huge fight.
And that's by who?
Amy Schumacher. She teaches creative writing at the University of Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
Great book.
All right. Well, and that'll do it for today. I'm Don Wooten with Rural Tweet. Thank you for joining us. And, of course, as always, next time to look forward to, we'll be back for another Scribble.